From CAFE, this is United Security. I'm Lisa Monaco.
And I'm Ken Weinstein.
Hey, good morning, Ken.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
What have you been doing since we last chatted?
Well, I'm actually visiting in-laws down in Alabama, where it's about 125 degrees.
Nice.
Enjoying it, though. And also sort of enjoying the aftermath of the two conventions. I think on our last episode, we were in the middle of the Democratic convention, or maybe just after it. And now we're on the heels of the RNC, which was quite a spectacle. What'd you think of it?
I'm not sure that enjoying the aftermath is a term that I would use, but boy, seeing the sights of the White House used as a backdrop and as the stage, literally the stage for a political convention, frankly, is never something I thought I would see.
But yeah, why didn't we think of that? What a great idea. You want to get to the White House? You use the White House.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Look, as I know you have, since we both had the privilege of working in the White House and on the White House grounds, was privileged to go to many events on the South Lawn, in the East Room, in so many of the amazing spaces and public spaces that the White House has, but never have seen it used for a partisan political event like that. It's just, we're in a different world.
Yeah, actually, I think you've identified something that's kind of gotten lost in the discussion. Everybody talks about the Hatch Act and whether it violated rules for the Republican campaign to use the White House. But I think there's a sort of additional, almost more important element to this, which is what you're talking about. There's a certain majesty and dignity to the White House, and it really is the people's house. And in my time there, everybody who was there walked around somewhat in awe and in respect of the White House and what it represented to the country. And the idea that it's used for something that is just for part of the country or part of the political spectrum runs completely counter to that whole notion.
Agree with that. But of course, we didn't come together today to talk about the RNC, although it definitely has figured prominently since our last recording. We've got a lot to discuss today, Ken.
Let's start with the announcement by the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, that they were going to be changing tack as it came to briefing Congress about the threat to the election, which, by the way, is right around the corner. And this was pretty noteworthy that on August 29th, however many days that is before the election, he announced, and then the president went ahead and confirmed and supported that announcement, that they would not be briefing Congress in person about what they were seeing regarding the election threat.
Now, I noticed that they did say that the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI will continue to provide oral briefings. But the DNI, Ratcliffe, is saying he and his office will no longer submit to or engage in in-person briefings. And so you may think, well, all right, what does all this mean? You know, what does it matter? And my reaction, Ken, to all this was, first, the Director of National Intelligence was created, as you know, after 9/11 as part of a series of reforms to be the coordinator, right, of the intelligence community, of the, you know, 16 or 17 different agencies who all make up the intelligence community. And the job of the DNI is to integrate all the different views and different expertise across the intelligence community and present both to policymakers at the White House sitting around the Situation Room table, as you and I did, and to Congress, what's called a community view. Now, you know, the rationale here, the asserted rationale, is evidently that there have been leaks from past briefings, and therefore the DNI says, well, we're not going to engage in in-person briefings. We'll still provide you written product. I have to say, that was kind of a head-scratcher for me, because I think if somebody wants to leak something, they can leak a written information from a written product just like they can leak from an oral briefing. So that was not very compelling. It didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. What did you think?
Yeah, I felt the same way. It's almost easier to leak a written document in some ways. You've got a script and it's easily conveyed to somebody else. I didn't buy that rationale. And the concern, of course, is that the administration is reluctant to explain what they see because they're worried that that's going to be used against them in the campaign. In other words, for instance, if it is broadly broadcast that the Russians are interfering in the election or trying to interfere in the campaign, and that they are trying to help Trump, which, of course, is the substance of the announcement that we discussed in our last episode, where Bill Evanina came out with a little bit more expanded announcement about what they're seeing, in which he gave still relatively sparse details about interference efforts by China, Russia, and Iran. And Russia, they acknowledged, was seeking to support Trump. And the concern is that the reluctance to brief is not a reluctance to run the risk of leaks, but rather a reluctance to share details about what the Russians are doing. And probably what the Russians are doing are on steroids compared to what's being done by China and Iran. And you know, the American people would then see and recognize that some of these influence efforts, some of the strains of narrative that are out in the press might well be sourced to Russia and should be looked at with a jaundiced eye. So I think they might be concerned about the possibility that the intelligence will be used exactly as we want the intelligence to be used by the American people, to be more skeptical of some of the claims they're seeing out there.
Right. And, you know, look, I think people justifiably, I think, would have probably three questions on this whole story. One is, should we care? Two is, does it really matter? And three, how really outside the norm is all of this? And my answers to those three questions are yes, yes, and substantially. So yes, it is something we should care about. Yes, I think it matters very, very much. And it is substantially outside the norm. And, you know, we should care about this because I think it puts the intelligence community yet again kind of in the political crosshairs, right? We're having this discussion because there does seem to be this kind of political taint to it. And I think in-person briefings really do matter because they're a critical part of the oversight that Congress has over the intelligence community.
Yeah, and I think you're right about it being outside the norm. And I think there's another sort of more inside baseball impact here, which is the Director of National Intelligence, as you said, that office and that position was instituted to be the quarterback of the intelligence community, to be the voice of the community.
I knew there was a sports metaphor to be had here somewhere.
Yeah. I'm anxious for football to start again. We'll see if it does.
You're not alone.
But the DNI was designed to do that. And in fact, Jim Clapper, the DNI, the Obama administration, played that role when the intelligence community assessment of what had happened in 2016 was rolled out in the beginning of January and briefed to the administration and to Congress. Here, if you have the DNI playing sort of a role in the background on what really probably or arguably is the intelligence issue of the moment, I wonder what that's going to do in the long term for the sort of the potency of the DNI position.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the last thing I'd say on this, Ken, is I think in-person briefings really do matter. You and I both have spent time sitting at those tables before the intelligence committees, before the Judiciary Committee, frankly, before a whole bunch of different committees. And it is a very different thing to be kind of subjected to probing questioning or any questioning on what you're putting forth, right, and engaging in a back and forth and having to answer maybe sometimes uncomfortable questions. Look, it wasn't always easy, for sure, but there's a real difference in, you know, having somebody read something that's been carefully crafted and put on the page maybe is susceptible to a lot of different nuanced interpretations and actually having to defend that and answer questions that it raises. And that's the purpose of the in-person briefing. And I think it's critical to oversight, which in turn is critical to having trust in the activities of our intelligence community.
Yeah, and to put some icing on that, it's critical to accountability because as an official going up to Congress to brief, when you have a member leaning over the podium, wagging his or her finger at you and asking a question that you can't answer or that you cannot give a sufficient answer, one that satisfies him or her, and that member says, you get back to me on this issue, you have to get back to them.
Right. I don't know about you, but I had a lot of finger wagging at me.
Oh, my gosh.
And we've got more breaking news, which is a story that just came out in the last day or two, which is that the Department of Homeland Security is kind of sitting on or has squelched from releasing a report from its own internal intelligence and analysis unit about an assessment of Russian efforts to put out disinformation and false information about Joe Biden. And so there is a report that the DHS secretary, the acting secretary, Chad Wolf, stopped that from going out.
The concern here is that Russia is putting out misinformation and they're trying to focus on things that they think might get traction among people who are considering whom to vote for. And here you have this intelligence report saying that the Russians are specifically putting out misinformation about Joe Biden's health and therefore his suitability as a candidate for president. That seems like it's pretty important news, and it's pretty important for the American voting public to know that. And it was, that report was withdrawn, and the rationale for withdrawing it was apparently it was not up to snuff in terms of its written quality. And the secretary recognized that the writing was not up to snuff and pulled it back.
Well, that's the asserted purpose, right? I mean, so two things to underscore here, and you made a very good point, Ken, which is to say the report reportedly was about how the Russians were putting out misinformation about asserting about Joe Biden's health. And it's important that that information get out there, this intelligence assessment get out there, so that the American people, when they see such misinformation, can say, ah, I get it. This maybe is an effort by the Russians to influence what I'm thinking in relation to the election, right? That is the purpose of putting out these types of intelligence assessments and alerts and letting the American people know the nature of the disinformation campaigns that Russia wages. And then, you know, the reporting is here that the acting Secretary of Homeland Security pulled this back, kind of stuck it in a drawer, but he has said it's because it was poorly written. Well, I don't know about you, Ken, but in my experience, the cabinet secretary level does not act as a copy editor.
I thought that was one of the criteria for vetting for cabinet secretary positions. Good with a red pen. So, well, we'll see if it sees the light of day. The response in the last hours, I think, has been that DHS will be putting something out. We'll see if it gets out. Okay, why don't we shift gears and start looking at the issue of domestic terrorism. And it's important to talk about that because the word terrorism and terrorist has an important meaning, both rhetorically and politically, but also legally. We've heard a good bit of talk recently about different groups and whether these groups, which might be involved in some of the more violent activities and protests that we're seeing around the country, whether these groups are terrorist groups or not. And I thought I'd start just with an understanding of what terrorism means. And under the law, there's a definition for international terrorism and definition for domestic terrorism. But terrorism basically is this. It comprises acts which are dangerous to human life that are against the law. And those acts are appeared to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, to influence the policy of the government through intimidation or coercion or violence, or to affect the conduct of the government, what the government does by engaging in mass destruction, assassination, kidnapping, et cetera. And so that is the general nature of terrorism. It's not just illegal activity. It's illegal activity with that kind of purpose. And just to sort of lay out a good example, you know, Timothy McVeigh, who blew up the federal building in Oklahoma, you know, he was upset about what the government had done in Waco and Ruby Ridge and overreaching by the federal government. He saw that our government is oppressive. He had problems with the U.S. foreign policy, and he wanted to trigger an uprising against the federal government. And that's why he engaged in that brutal attack on innocent people. That, it seems like a paradigmatic example of a terrorist act. And the question is whether some of these groups that we're seeing now and that we're hearing about now in the news are terrorist groups or not terrorist groups. And one of the ones that we've discussed recently, we've heard a lot about in the press, is the group called Antifa. And I think just recently, at the end of May, the president tweeted that the U.S. would be designating Antifa as a terrorist organization. So let me tee that up. And what do you make of that, Lisa?
Yeah. So you know, as you said, the president said he's going to be designating Antifa as a terrorist organization. I think the kind of force of that was basically simply a Twitter post, because there's no actual mechanism in our law to designate a domestic group a terror organization. So that's, I think, the first point. You know, the Attorney General Barr has referred to Antifa as a new form of, quote, guerrilla warfare, unquote. And he described it as insinuating itself into demonstrations and provoking violence. He also, in an interview that I read, he used kind of a weird fish metaphor, referring to how Mao Zedong described terrorism.
It's a form of sort of, it's a new form of urban guerrilla warfare. You know, Mao Zedong used to speak about the guerrilla being like fish swimming in the ocean, the way the gorilla moves through the people. The gorilla hides out among the people as a fish in the ocean.
That was a little bit strange. But look, the bottom line here is the experts who have really looked at this and tried to examine Antifa have assessed that it's a loosely affiliated group of far-left anti-fascism activists. It's not an organization with a clear structure or defined membership, and it's more of a movement with a shared philosophy and tactics, and the philosophy is one of anti-fascism and the kind of campaign against what they define as authoritarianism or xenophobia, racism, and it's really gained a lot of attention after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. So it's, on the one hand, I think it's hard to think about it as the same type of organizations that we think about when we think about designating terrorism organizations like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, which have leadership structures that our intelligence community has identified and can assign. I mean, you and I know, because we spent many, many years looking at intelligence and working across the intelligence community to understand the leadership structure of Al-Qaeda. You know, who are the operations commanders, who are the training commanders, who are the plotters and the planners. We don't have that when we are talking about the types of groups that you just referenced. So I think it poses a real challenge, the type of rhetoric that we're seeing coming out of President Trump and Attorney General Barr is, it feels to me like it's trying to have rhetorical force, but it is less rooted in actually meeting a kind of legal definition of a terrorist group. I think the last thing I'd say is, I think that we ought to be labeling and assigning, you know, clear labels to actions that happen, to behavior that happens, and we ought to call that what it is.
Yeah, and I think you referenced an interesting point. You talked about Attorney General Barr quoting Mao Zedong, which is not a usual source of quotes for yeah. high-level government officials in the United States.
Yeah.
But his point was a valid one in the sense that, obviously, you know, the vast majority of the people going to the protests, I think, all went out to protest to make a point, which is in line with the American tradition of expressing oneself freely. There were some number of people who engaged in violence and who did use the protests as an opportunity to engage in violence, whether that was looting or physical violence against the police, what have you. And then the question is that act, to your point, is that act a terrorist act? And if it's a terrorist act, is it being done on behalf of a definable group? And that's a tough one. It's tough to say that there was one group that was organized specifically or organize itself specifically to engage in violence in order to make a public statement.
Right, to influence, to again, meet the definition of terrorism that you outlined, I think very well, Ken, at the start, you know, to engage in that violence, to intimidate a civilian population and to influence the policy of the government, importantly, through mass destruction, kidnapping, and assassination, right? That's the definition that our laws assign to terrorist acts, right? So I think we just have to be very precise. You know, what caught my eye also, Ken, recently is also in the breaking news category, a former Trump official. This was the a woman by the name of Elizabeth Newman, who was the assistant secretary within the Department of Homeland Security. She was the assistant secretary for counterterrorism and threat prevention at DHS. She made news in the last week by saying that the White House failed to take domestic extremism, and specifically what she characterized as right-wing extremism, they failed to take that seriously. And she has said, she told NPR quite specifically with regard to Antifa, she told NPR, the threat of, and this is a quote, the threat of domestic terrorism is not from Antifa, it is from these right-wing movements.
Somewhat associated with peaceful protests is Antifa. And yet, if you look at the arrests that have occurred in the protests of the summer, it's the Boogaloo movement, or it's an association with QAnon. It's the right side of the spectrum. It is not Antifa.
So it's made all the more complicated by the fact that now we're putting these assessments, it feels like, also through a little bit of a partisan lens. And I think that's unfortunate, too.
Right. And there are some of these groups out there who are sort of, to put simplistically, sort of on the right side of the political spectrum.
Right. Yeah. And we should talk about those, right? That's Boogaloo and QAnon. Those come to mind.
Yeah, exactly. So Boogaloo is this movement that's come to the fore recently, in particular since the Black Lives Matter movement has gotten traction over the last few months since the murder of George Floyd. And it's this group, loosely affiliated people who sort of agree with gun ownership and carrying guns openly, and who advocate generally for some sort of uprising against the overreaching federal government. And these folks have shown up at the various protests around the country and oftentimes carrying firearms. And their idea purportedly is to try to foment a revolution to break down what they see as a repressive and oppressive federal government. That's Boogaloo. You also have QAnon, which we've heard a lot about recently, in part because the president made some statements that seem to cozy up to QAnon a little bit. And QAnon is definitionally, it's, you know, a movement, once again, that seems like a fringe phenomenon. It's a specifically pro-Trump conspiracy theory that puts out notions that the president was actually... President Trump specifically was asked by a group of military generals to come in and save the country from a criminal conspiracy of people on the left who are Satan worshiping and engaged in child sex trafficking and the like. And the people who were identified as being responsible for that are Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, George Soros, and the like. And according to this QAnon conspiracy theory, Trump has been brought in specifically to do battle with these evil forces, and it's up to them to spread the word and solicit support for the president's efforts. And it's actually catching. I mean, down in Georgia just recently, a woman who is a professed QAnon believer just won the primary in a very conservative district for Congress. And so presumably that person is going to be elected on Election Day and is going to be in the U.S. Congress professing this QAnon conspiracy theory.
Yeah, and President Trump, I think, has called her a rising star, right, in the Republican Party.
Right. And back to what I said at the outset, when asked about QAnon, and when given the opportunity to say they're a bunch of crackpots and shouldn't be listened to, the president actually sort of said, well, I know they're gaining in popularity, and I know they like me very much, which he appreciates. And then he said that... These are people that
don't like seeing what's going on in places like Portland and places like Chicago and New York and other cities and states. And I've heard these are people that love our country and they just don't like seeing it.
Look, to say it's fringe is I think, an understatement. I mean, what the definition that you just rattled off about QAnon is really just bizarre. You see kind of how the organization that you and I used to work for, the FBI, it poses a real challenge for how to kind of think about these organizations, right? So the FBI had put out an intelligence bulletin where they did classify QAnon as a fringe political entity of sorts. And, you know, it's how do you inform the public about and your partners in state and local law enforcement and at Homeland Security, kind of fusion centers, right? These are the state organizations with Homeland Security responsibility. How do you talk about these entities and it really have a nomenclature about how to think about them when they really do involve really such kind of bizarre theories, right, and conspiracy theories? I think it's a real challenge for our former agency.
Yeah, it is a challenge. And look, it's a challenge to look at any of these groups that are engaged in anything that's either potential violence or real stone cold violence and decide whether they should be considered terrorists or a terrorist group or not. And another example of that issue is with MS-13, which is this gang that was recently charged with terrorist activities, and that those charges were announced by the president and by Attorney General Barr personally. And it was an overarching indictment of a number of the leaders of that group. And they very specifically called out MS-13 as a terrorist organization. And just for background, MS-13 is a group that has its roots back in the 1980s. It came up from Central America. It's now on several continents. Has 50 to 70,000 members. And it's not really like a traditional mafia family or organized crime organization that's focused on generating revenue. It's more like a social organization that uses violence as the lifeblood of the organization. Members use violence, sometimes gratuitous violence against innocent people, just for purposes of making their bones, establishing themselves as members, cementing loyalty to the group. And as a result, it is a very vicious organization that has caused untold misery and death around the world. And it's a real problem. So certainly these people deserve to be charged. The question, though, is whether they truly do satisfy the elements of a terrorist organization.
Yeah, I mean, this really struck me, this indictment that came down in July. You and I know from our past as prosecutors, as federal prosecutors, MS-13 has been the focus of investigators and prosecutors and a big law enforcement focus for many, many years, right? I can remember substantial investigations into MS-13 activity when I was an assistant U.S. attorney. But this indictment that was announced in July that you referenced, this is the first time that the Justice Department has charged MS-13 as terrorist. Now, the question is, what does that mean? Since we've already said that there is no such thing as a domestic terrorism statute, at least not yet. So think about the McVeigh case that you gave. Quintessential definition of a terrorist act on U.S. soil, an act of domestic terrorism. But, you know, the charges there were for murder and use of a weapon of mass destruction, right? This massive car bomb or a bomb that was in a U-Haul truck, right? And similarly, the Boston Marathon bombers. The Boston Marathon bomber was charged with murder and with use of a weapon of mass destruction. So not charged with domestic terrorism. There is no such charge in our criminal laws yet. But, you know, MS-13 and the announcement that came in July was really for conspiracy to use the proceeds of cocaine sales and to oversee murders and kidnapping and gun and drug smuggling, but also for engaging in terrorism transcending national boundaries, right? So it had that international link. So you really do see there's no domestic terrorism charge here, right? So you wonder, why did they take that extra step to add this kind of terrorism label to MS-13 when they've been prosecuting MS-13 gang members using the conspiracy statutes and other statutes on the books for years? What do you make of that, Ken?
Well, it seems like a stretch to me, because if you just look back at the life of MS-13, they really don't take political stances. And so therefore you sort of wonder how the federal government is going to be able to prove up that the purposes behind the violent activities that are charged in the indictment were to, let's say, influence a government or coerce the American people. It'd be interesting to see how they're able to prove that up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I have a theory here, which is, you know, they're I think they're kind of leaning on something that the Obama administration did back in 2011, which was issue an executive order about significant transnational criminal organizations, right? So these are criminal organizations that transcend and work across different countries, whether it's in their, you know, drug or gun or human smuggling operations, you name it. And President Obama did issue an executive order discussing these types of transnational criminal organizations and referred to MS-13 in that context. And, in, you know, went so far as to say that these types of significant transnational criminal organizations threaten the stability of international political and economic systems.
But that doesn't thereby qualify it as a terrorist organization.
Right. So it really begs the question, why are they now all of a sudden assigning this terrorism label? And I think you can't avoid the implication here that, one, it's to try and get a more of a kind of rhetorical bounce here, because everyone sits up a little bit straighter, pays a little bit more attention when you assign the terrorism label. And, you know, there is, it does feel to be kind of in the same vein as this, the kind of immigration focus and the us and them rhetoric that has been part and parcel of the administration's focus on immigration. There's been lots of fairly baseless claims made about immigrants coming across the southern border and there being ties to terrorist organizations. Those have actually not been borne out in intelligence. And, you know, there's been, you know, precious little evidence for those claims, but it does seem intended to kind of merge the immigration debate with the very charged language of terrorism. What do you think?
I agree with you. Immigration is a huge issue. The president's made it a big issue since he campaigned before the 2016 election. That's a primary concern of a lot of his supporters. And as you say, one of the themes of his rhetoric has been that there are terrorists flooding over the southern border and that there are MS-13 members coming in with the caravans and the like. And so I think that there is political benefit to bringing this indictment at this time leading up to the election to appeal to those people who are very concerned about immigration. And we've been talking about the sort of foreign domestic distinction between organizations and how they're classified. Just to keep in mind, on the foreign side, when we're talking about foreign organizations, there's a whole structure in place by which the federal government can designate a foreign organization as a foreign terrorist organization, FTO. The State Department maintains a list. And if a group like Al-Qaeda or ISIS is put on that list, then there are certain ramifications. And, you know, there are sanctions applied, et cetera. And one of the things that happens is if somebody were to provide material support to those organizations, or one of those organizations, that person will have violated the material support to terrorism statute.
Oh, yeah, I bet you're going to say this, Ken. I mean, that material support can be anything from money to weapons to providing yourself.
Right. So mere membership.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right. So in other words, if you're a member, you go over and join ISIS as a member, whether you explode a bomb or you actually take violent action against anybody, you have violated the law by providing material support, i.e. yourself, to that group. That passes constitutional muster when it comes to foreign organizations. The concern, of course, is on the domestic side, where you have the right to free speech, right of association, whether the government could classify a domestic organization as terrorist and thereby make it a violation of federal law for somebody to join that and become a member of that organization without actually engaging in any terrorist activity.
No, it's such a good point. And, you know, there's real First Amendment hurdles to that. And that, you know, that I think is a good transition to the question that now has regularly come up, which is, should we have a domestic terrorism statute, right? We described how Timothy McVeigh and Boston Marathon bomber, they weren't charged with domestic terrorism, but other violations of criminal law. So, you know, what do you think on this score? Do prosecutors have enough tools already at their disposal to bring charges to address what we all would agree, for instance, the Oklahoma City bombing is an act of domestic terrorism. Do you think we need a new law?
There are a number of arguments for such a law, and one of them is sort of rhetorical and is sort of more for optical, important but optical benefit, which is, like, we have these statutes for foreign terrorist organizations. Many of them target Muslim organizations, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the like. And we don't have a comparable structure for domestic organizations, many of which might be, you know, white nationalist type of groups. And is that disparate treatment? And some commentators have said, look, there's real value in having a structure imposed on domestic groups for that very purpose, so that Muslim communities don't feel like they're being unfairly singled out for harsh legal treatment, and folks on the white nationalist side who might be just as violent, just as dangerous, do not get that treatment. That's one of the sort of the arguments for why it'd be useful to have a statute as a practical matter. I think you've made the point quite well that prosecutors are resourceful. There are lots of statutes on the books, and if somebody is actually engaging in violence, they can be prosecuted either for having engaged in that violence or conspiracy to engage in violence if the plot is revealed before the violence actually happens, or aiding and abetting violent acts. And so it's hard to think of any terrorism-type cases that have happened on our soil and we've been unable to prosecute them effectively with the statutes that are on the books.
That said, you know, I think that's right. But I think there's two questions, right? Do you have a charge that you can bring that can address the activity and deter that individual and do justice, right? And achieve the objectives that you're seeking, which is to bring that individual to justice, to imprison them, to keep them from repeating that activity. And yes, there's many laws on the books that I think get at a lot of this activity. I think it's a separate question. I actually think there's something we should look at in terms of whether there is an ability to carefully craft legislation that would allow us to assign some of the same moral opprobrium to acts of terrorism that are motivated by domestic extremism and domestic grievances, that same moral opprobrium that we assign to those motivated by international terror groups or conducted by international terror groups. Miriam Accord, who is our former colleague from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia and from the National Security Division at the Justice Department, she's written about this quite extensively and has called for such a domestic terrorism law, one that is carefully crafted that would address the First Amendment concerns here. And Adam Schiff, he's proposed legislation that would create such a statute. And importantly, not classifying new criminal conduct, but rather criminalizing conduct done that is already a crime, right? But done with an intent to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, right? As domestic terrorism. I think that's pretty important.
Yeah, and Mary makes a very persuasive case. And as you and I have written on this topic in the past, domestic terrorism is an issue that hasn't gotten the attention that it should. International terrorism, of course, was all the focus after 9/11. It killed 3,000 of our people, and so it understandably and appropriately was our focus. But look, we've seen more and more domestic terrorism, whether it's the various shootings around the country, killings in black churches and the like. And I think this is a time to be leaning forward, both to legislate laws that in practical terms assist law enforcement to go after people who engage in that kind of activity, but also to send the message, as you point out, that we're going to go as hard against people who kill as white nationalists as we are for, you know, religious zealots who kill as international terrorists, you know, bent on a jihad. And I think that's an important point.
The other thing I think Mary points to a very, I think, concrete example. She points to this of conduct that could be addressed and fill a gap that she sees that needs filling. And this was this case of a former Coast Guard lieutenant, a man by the name of Christopher Paul Hassan, who was arrested in the last couple of years for plotting the murder of notable Democrats and journalists. And he was stockpiling weapons. He was ultimately charged with, you know, for this purpose. And he was ultimately charged with some drug and some minor firearms offenses. But those charges weren't enough to actually get him detained, right? The judge noted that they weren't sufficient based on the guy's prior record to actually hold him. Now, that ultimately got addressed by a later judge. But that was a challenge for the prosecutors. And I think Mary's point is, if you had a domestic terrorism law of the kind that she has written about on the books, you could say, well, it could be a violation of such a statute to stockpile firearms with the intent of, or with the purpose of, conducting an attack that meets a domestic terrorism definition, right? And prosecutors and investigators wouldn't have to actually wait for the person to take a step towards that action. Now, look, that makes some people very uneasy, right? That you're getting into a dangerous line here. But she does, I think, do a good job of identifying a specific kind of fact pattern that such a statute would address.
Yeah, and Adam Schiff's statute or proposed bill has gotten the support of a number of important entities. I saw the FBI Agents Association came out in support of it. And I think the more we see this violence, particular right-wing domestic violence, that I think more momentum will build for some kind of domestic terrorism statute.
So I think one thing we should point out, Ken, is because we were talking about this notion of, well, can you designate Antifa, for instance, as a terror organization? You know, the type of carefully crafted domestic terrorism legislation that we've been talking about, and then I know that Mary McCord and the Adam Schiff legislation contemplates, would not, and I emphasize, would not include the ability to designate domestic groups as terror groups, like the foreign terror organization designation that the State Department has that you referenced earlier. And that's, of course, because of the important First Amendment protections that we have. You don't want, you know, the danger of having such a, quote, designation capability would be that, you know, you could develop an enemies list, right? And you know, one political party's view of an organization might be different than another. So I think that's really important to be clear about, that the advocates for some of the more well-crafted domestic terror legislation would not include such a designation capability. And then the last thing I'd say is, you know, something that is in the Schiff legislation would require a lot of very clear and transparent reporting by the FBI as to how they are using this power. And I think that's really important for oversight and accountability.
This discussion reminds me of situation that you and I dealt with back in, you know, the post 9/11 era, when we were really focused on terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda that were trying to kill Americans. But at the same time, there came to the fore two groups that were focused on environmental terrorism, as it was called at the time. And those groups are ALF and ELF, the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front, which are two groups that swore off violence against individuals or against animals, but we're focused on causing property damage to make the point that we need to protect the environment and that we need to protect animals. So they, you know, did a number of arsons, including an arson of a lodge out at in Vail, in the ski resort out at in Colorado. They undertook violent acts against companies that were using animals in various ways. And there were a lot of incidents over the years where they caused property damage to the tune of many millions of dollars, but didn't actually hurt any individuals. The FBI went hard after those cases. I remember Bob Mueller announcing a big indictment involving these kind of quote-unquote terrorists, and charges were brought against them, and they were branded as terrorists, even though they didn't actually focus on injuring human beings.
Today's indictment marks the culmination of an intensive investigation by the FBI, as well as our partners, including ATF, an investigation focused on a group of individuals who have committed numerous violent acts in the name of animal rights and environmental causes. But terrorism is terrorism, no matter what the motive. The FBI is committed to protecting Americans from crime and terrorism, including acts of domestic terrorism, in the name of animal rights or the environment. And there is a clear difference between constitutionally protected advocacy, which is the right of all Americans, and violent criminal activity. It is one thing to write concerned letters or to hold peaceful demonstrations, It is another thing entirely to construct and use improvised explosives or incendiary devices to harass and intimidate victims by destroying property and to cause millions of dollars in losses by acts or threats of violence.
Which is just an interesting point because, once again, it's a question of classification. Both legal designation, in which, as we pointed out, there's no designation for terrorist groups domestically, but also just classifying a group as a terrorist group. Here we've got these people who are focused on the environment and animal rights are considered terrorists because of the acts they undertake, because they're taking those acts to influence the way that the government addresses environmental and animal rights issues. Therefore, it fits the definition of terrorism. Interesting question that we wrestled with back then, and we're seeing different permutations of that issue here with the different groups that we've gone through today.
You know, Ken, as we're talking about our former colleague, Mary McCord, and she worked in the National Security Division that you and I both led, you know, it strikes me that the right candidate for our unsung hero for this week ought to be those prosecutors and intelligence analysts and intelligence professionals that we worked with both in the National Security Division and, frankly, across both the FBI and other parts of the intelligence community, who have to keep up with these very dynamic, fraught, quite frankly, threats, whether it's from election security to the domestic terrorism difficulties that we just were talking about. It's a hard job to kind of navigate the nuances and the evolving threat environment. And so I think my hat's off to the folks who are doing that day in and day out.
Yeah, and look, being partial to prosecutors, because we were both prosecutors and we were both in the National Security Division, I'm going to feature the prosecutors for a second here. But, you know, we've talked about the difficulties of fitting the current statutes to the different types of activity that we're seeing out there, some of which can be considered criminal. And what you have in the National Security Division is people who become expert in using the current statutes that are on the books to try to bring those statutes to bear in situations that are deserving of criminal prosecution. And also you have people of that division going to Congress and telling Congress, these are the statutes we need and here's why, or these are the statutes that should be reformed or revised and here's why. And that happens with regularity. The executive branch weighs in regularly at the level of the experts to tell Congress, this is why we need these statutes. We're seeing this threat. We think that threat is not being fully addressed by the statutes we currently have, and we need the following statutes. And I'm sure that process is ongoing right now, and I'm sure there was a lot of input from our former colleagues in the National Security Division before Adam Schiff put out his proposed legislation for domestic terrorism law.
So that's it for this week, Ken. I think that's all we've got time for. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. In the meantime, if people have questions or comments, please send those to letters@cafe.com.
All right. Please send them to us and we'll do our best to answer them in our next episode. And all the best.
That's it for this week's episode of the United Security Podcast. Your hosts are Lisa Monaco and Ken Weinstein. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tadashore. And the CAFE team is David Kurlander, Nat Wiener, Matthew Billy, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Board, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. Our music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you for being a part of the CAFE Insider community.